Westwood One presents Two Chairs and a Microphone.
Checking 1, 2.
Here's your host, Paul Mercurio.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for checking out the podcast. Before we get to my guest this week, I just want to say a big thank you to everybody that came out to Levity Live this weekend, the comedy club out in Nyack, New York. Had a great time. Beautiful club. Ton of people came out. Had a blast. There's a lot of cool pictures that I posted on Facebook and Twitter. You can check them out. So I really love that you guys all came out. Really appreciate it. And the numbers on the podcast are growing. I want to thank everybody who's been listening and welcome our new listeners and keep telling your friends and spread the word. It's a free subscription and on iTunes. And please go to iTunes and review the podcast. That helps. We need more reviews, please. More is good. And appreciate it very much. This weekend, I'm going to be in New York City performing at different clubs in the city, Comedy Cellar, Comic Strip, Stand Up New York Comedy Club. And then the following week, March 23rd to the 26th, I am in Edmonton, Canada at the Comic Strip Comedy Club in Edmonton, Canada. And March 30th to April 1st, I'm at the San Francisco Punchline. Great, great club. Historic club. Love going there. Great audiences. Come on out, hang out, have a good time. My guest this week, Michael Imperioli. Really, really, really interesting guy. Great, great actor, as you know, from The Sopranos. We talk about a lot of stuff, including working on The Sopranos, working with Spike Lee, working with Robert De Niro. It's just a lot of cool stuff. And I got a little comedy for you. Here's a little jokey joke from an appearance I did recently. Enjoy that. Enjoy the podcast. Please review the podcast on iTunes. Tell your friends about it. See you next week.
I always wanted to learn a foreign language. I feel like I should, you know, be able to speak a foreign language. I was going to take a course. It's expensive. So instead, and you could use this idea, I'm learning a foreign language by reading the owner's manuals to my electronics. Huh? Yeah. These are my speakers. They're in like 8 different languages. Chinese, German. I know German. Check this out, page 26. Das ist ein Busch, ein Innum, Subwoofer. I'm not exactly sure what this means, but when I read it, I am scared to death of my subwoofer. I'm learning French. Now, there's lots of different kinds of French. There's advanced French, there's intermediate French. I'm learning George Foreman grill French. Yeah. It's the most beautiful of the romance manuals. Yeah. The other night, my wife's mad at me. I had to pay her a compliment. Like, she's like, whatever. So I just like go to the manual, like French, go to page 17. I said, sweetie, I'm sorry. You're beautiful. Your face looks just like a glissé le bac pour, which apparently is a grease-catching drip tray.
We got a very, very special guest this week, someone whose work I've admired for a long, long time, a fellow Italian, Michael Imperioli, from The Sopranos, Goodfellas, Jungle Fever, Californication, Emmy Award nominee, Golden Globe nominee. Thank you for being on the show, and one of the stars of a movie that is out right now, Wannabe, thank you for being on the podcast, man.
Thank you for having me, Paul.
Yeah, absolutely. And so we were talking a little bit initially about The Wannabe and your role in it. You play Alphonse, who's the older brother to the lead character. And it's a really interesting story about inspired by the John Gotti trial. And I'd love for you to sort of elaborate on that a little bit for the listeners.
It's a story of a young man named Thomas, played by the actor Vincent Piazza, and he is a young guy who grew up in Queens in a neighborhood where there was a mob presence, and he's always been infatuated by mob movies and James Cagney and Al Pacino and all that, and by the real gangsters, especially John Gotti. And the story takes place in 1992 when John Gotti was on trial. During the course of the movie, he hooks up with this older woman. And they go, they have this crazy love affair. They get married and they go on this Bonnie and Clyde crime spree where they rob mafia social clubs where they're having card games and they steal all the cash and jewelry and they live this crazy drug-fueled lifestyle. He really wants to ingratiate himself into the Gambino family and become a mobster. And what he comes up with this scheme to try to tamper with the jury of the Gotti trial in an effort to, you know, get in good with Gotti. Mm-hmm. And part of this story is based on something true, not the jury tampering part, but there was this couple, on this young man who wanted to be a mobster and was robbing these mob social clubs after they kind of spurned his advances.
Mm-hmm. And talk about flirting with disaster. What does somebody think at that point is going to happen? Once you start stealing from the mob, you can't go back and say, I made a mistake, I apologize. I think that's...
No, I think he started, you know, kind of thinking, well, screw it, these people aren't going to pay me any attention, so I'm going to show them
right.
that I'm as bad as they are.
Right. You know? And there's from what I've seen of it, there's a slight sort of comedic feel to it at times, which obviously I would imagine is intended and sort of... It sort of gives it a nice balance in a way.
There's some funny things that happen kind of out of the insanity. Where the two main characters go, played by Vincent Piazza and Patricia Arquette, who's amazing in the film as well. So is Vincent. But it's a lot of comedy is uncomfortable comedy. Like, for instance, the character Thomas goes into a bar. This is 1992, and he sees Eric Roberts. There's actually an actor who's playing Eric Roberts, mm-hmm. you know, however old he was in 1992. So Thomas sees Eric Roberts and kind of almost confuses him with his character in Pulp Greenwich Village, calling him Paulie, and they do coke together, and then he starts befriending him, and he kind of says he's kind of upset with him because he turned into a rat in the movie, and Eric Roberts is trying to explain that he's an actor, and this happens early in the movie, and then he goes into the same bar later on. He sees Eric Roberts again, and now he's more drugged out, this character, and a little more desperate, and it really kind of turns ugly, their encounter. Mm. And there's elements of King of Comedy in there,
yeah,
definitely, you know, and Taxi Driver kind of touched on it too, you know, this whole an outsider looking into this kind of world that he perceives as special and romantic, and trying to, you know, get in there in very twisted, perverted ways.
You mentioned Taxi Driver. We should mention Martin Scorsese is one of the executive producers. And how are his fingerprints on this film in terms of consulting on writing, on the look, on the way it's shot? Where did he layer his brilliance?
Well, Vincent Piazza was working on Boardwalk Empire at the time when he got the script. So was the director, Nick Sandow, who's also an actor, the writer-director. And Vincent showed it to Marty because Scorsese was a director and producer of Boardwalk Empire, and Marty liked it and said, I'd like to executive produce it. So in the beginning, he was really, you know, helping them, you know, get the money together and get it into production. And I think Marty was helpful to Nick, the director, in the post-production and gave him some notes on, you know, some advice for editing.
Yeah.
Really, you know, just kind of guide and stuff. He really let Nick make the movie he wanted to make. And I think Marty was really kind and generous with, you know, helping him do that.
That's great. Nick is also in Orange is the New Black, right?
He plays the warden to Pluto.
Right, and you in the Wannabe play Alphonse, who's the older brother to Vincent. And it's funny because in hearing you describe it, you're trying to kind of keep him on the straight and narrow, right?
Yeah, my character is, you know, an average guy, straight and narrow kind of life, inherited the family businesses, florist shop. I'm quite a bit older than Vincent's character. And Vincent's been in and out of trouble for a while with drugs and with the law. And I tried to help, but it's, you know, he's also realized that maybe it might be best to keep a boundary because I have my own family and I don't want that to, you know, be jeopardized. And, I also don't want to be an enabler for an addict. And
right.
part of it is that my character realizes that maybe I can't really help, you know what I mean? There's only so much you could do if someone's not willing to help themselves.
Well, that's got to be hard for your character. And I almost feel like, and if I'm off on this, tell me, but he is Chris from The Sopranos and you're Tony maybe? No, although Tony wasn't straight and narrow, but like it sounds like you're the one of reason, and he's sort of the wild spitfire, which I think your niece initially on The Sopranos, your character was. I don't know. Is there a parallel there a little bit for you? Are you seeing you on the other side of it now a little bit? in this character?
Yeah, in some ways I could see that, you know. He was taking an interest in trying to keep somebody who was really screwing up. And
yeah.
There's some parallels there.
So, in some of the work you've done and the directors that you've worked with, like, Spike Lee and Jungle Fever, Malcolm X, Clocker. So what is it about working with him and that clicks for you and vice versa? Because, you know, it's very rare, I think, right, that actors get to sort of go back to the well with great directors and vice versa. He going back to the well with you as a great actor, obviously De Niro with Scorsese. And I'm fascinated by how that came about, that kind of relationship.
I've worked with Spike on 6 movies.
Yeah.
And Spike tends to be very loyal with people that he works with, first of all. Mm-hmm. From my point of view, number one, I have a great deal of admiration for him. I think he's one of the few American filmmakers who has always done what he wants to do, has never sold out, has never done any, you know, done the big movie to, you know, cash in or something like that, or raise his profile. He always does a Spike Lee movie and follows his heart and speaks his mind, mm-hmm. and is a very big influence in this country, you know, politically and socially. And I admire that a great deal, and I admire his filmmaking storytelling.
Especially when you're making a product in an industry that really cares a lot about the bottom line. You know what I mean? Like to not only be true to your voice and your point of view, but then be fighting a system internally that's inherently designed and built to not want to do films like that, right? It's really remarkable that he continues.
It's remarkable.
Yeah.
And as an actor, it's wonderful to work with Spike because he expects a lot from his actors. He expects you to bring your whole bag of tricks and have, you know, sometimes that means improvisation and mm-hmm. filling out your character and coming up with ideas and taking chances. And he loves that, encourages and wants.
That's surprising to hear. Like so you could walk in and go, you know, I was reading over my scene last night and I was thinking about this. And would he actually think about changing dialogue if he felt that you...
Loves to do that.
Wow. Loves that's interesting. That.
I mean, he, you know... I'm sure he'd be the first to say if it's something doesn't work, he doesn't like it, he tells you, but he wants you to come up with ideas. He wants to see, mm-hmm. you know, he trusts the actor, you know, he wants to see where they're at and how they think into his work and into his scripts. And that's, for an actor, that's a lot of fun.
Yeah, right. I mean, it just brings it to a whole new level. You're not just sort of carrying out instructions and sort of hitting lines. You're like, you really feel invested in the project on a whole other level. You know, I was reading about you grew up in the Bronx and...
I grew up in Mount Vernon, New York.
Next to the Bronx, right. And your dad was a bus driver, right?
He was in the Bronx, yeah. He drove a city bus in the Bronx.
Right, that's right. And
exactly.
did he dabble in amateur drama? Was he aspiring to be an actor?
He started doing community theater.
He did.
When I was a teenager, yeah.
And,
which I always thought was very brave, you know, because he never had done that before. Now he was, I guess, 40 years old.
Yeah.
And he just decided he wanted, he always loved movies. And I think I got a lot of my love for it through his love for it, and turned me on to a lot of cool stuff. But I thought it was very brave of somebody who has no experience and that to get on a stage all of a sudden at 40 years old and because you really put your ass on the line when you go on stage.
Yeah.
Much more so than on film, you know, because there's no second take on stage. And that definitely inspired me.
What was it like the first time you saw him and what was the role that he was playing? Do you remember?
It was a courtroom drama. I can't remember the name of the play. Mm. It's not a very well-known play. I don't think it was by a famous writer. Mm. And he played the clerk of the court. And it was a kind of play where they took members of the audience to be members of the jury.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the members of the audience got to sit in the jury box on stage.
Mm-hmm.
And I forget the name of the play.
That's great, though. My father put floors in for a living, a blue-collar Italian guy. I couldn't imagine him going up and doing that. That's so cool. Like, that's like, it's seeing another side, and seeing another side of your dad, you know? That's like, that's wild. And And then did he start to take, or your mom or both start to take you to like some plays in the city, off Broadway stuff, to kind of just as a fan to go see? And is that where you started to get your interest in all of this?
We went to see some plays when I was young, you know. Yeah. You know, definitely saw theater and cool movies, and they were very they also were very supportive when I decided I wanted to take out, you know, instead of going to college, I went to acting classes, and they were, which was very, I kind of sprung that last minute on them. They knew I was interested in it, but I was planning on going to college. It was actually the night before I was supposed to leave for college.
Wow.
You know, after the summer, I was already graduated, and I went to orientation to the school over the summer, and I kind of made this last minute decision. And, you know, they were still surprised, but you know, they were very supportive, which I'm grateful for.
Yeah. You know, it's something I was a lawyer and a banker and quit to be a comedian and an actor. And it's not something you can logic your way through. It's just something you kind of have to do. And I would imagine the same thing with you. I mean, logic says go to school, go to college and get a solid job and be secure. Right. But obviously there was something that was that was in you, that was really passionate about acting, was just pulling you, I would imagine, right?
Yeah. But it was just something that seemed so far out, because, I mean, my father did community theater, but at that time we were living an hour north of the city in Brewster, New York, in Putnam County. The idea of becoming an actor just was not feasible. Right. You know, there was we didn't know anybody in the business, in the professional business. And it just seemed like, how do you go about doing that?
And, someone asked me that the other day in an interview. I was like, did you know I was like, no, I didn't know I was going to be into entertainment. It was just a box in our living room and stuff came out of it. And I watched it, and my father put floors in for a living. My mother had a little furniture business. Nobody in my family had anything to do with it. It was like, I grew up in Rhode Island, New England, but, you know, miles away from any of it. And then whatever, it just kind of grabs you. But you also did like 10 years on Law & Order. Was that a great sort of, I mean,
you I didn't do 10 years on Law & Order.
Because I saw in the, it says 1996 to 2006, it had in your IMDb.
No, but, I did a guest spot in probably around 94, 95 with Jerry Orbach when he was on the show. And then some point during The Sopranos, maybe around 2002 or 3, I filled in for Jesse Martin when he was one of the lead. He was the lead with Dennis Farina, and he went to do a movie.
Right.
He's a friend of mine. And I wound up filling in for him for, I think it was either 4 or 6 episodes as one of the lead guys. Yeah, that was the only time I did it.
How, you know, you see, in reading about you, you see a lot about, you know, your big break was in Goodfellas, and, you know, you end up getting shot by Joe Pesci. But for you, was that sort of, I mean, in seminal, or in terms of the creative part of it, like, was there a turning point in a particular role or a particular experience where you go, okay, I just moved to the next level? I'm not necessarily talking about like sort of notoriety, which I would imagine Goodfellas gave you on some level, but like just sort of like, all right, I just turned the corner here and I'm kind of in the next level.
Well, there's several times that happened. You know, I mean, the first time I got a play, which was off Broadway, which was a professional. My first professional acting job, which was about 4 years into me pursuing acting and studying acting. And then the next year I got my first role in a movie, which was one mine, which got cut. But and then the year after that I did Goodfellas, and that was a big landmark for me, because I was working with people who were legends. Mm-hmm. You know, that was kind of like being called up from the minor leagues to play in World Series with the Yankees.
Yeah, I can imagine.
That, to me, that's what that was like. So, but it was another couple of years after Goodfellas until I started making a living. Because after Goodfellas, I still was working in restaurants and stuff in New York. So even though I'd done something that was, you know.
Yeah, I was going to say, you'd think that would, and not necessarily you're starting to buy Ferraris, but like you can at least kind of pay your rent and, you know, not have to. That's interesting.
No, yeah, that didn't happen for another couple of years.
And when you're on that set with the likes of Joe Pesci and De Niro and sort of, you know, you can't be intimidated, but you can't help but be intimidated, right? I mean, to do your job right, you can't be intimidated. I mean, so how do you prepare yourself for something like that? Like
the good thing was is that Marty Scorsese, as soon as I got to the set, first of all, he spends a lot of his time rehearsing on the shoot day. You know, not before the movie. He might do it before the movie. I didn't do that on Goodfellas, but the shoot day, half of the day was rehearsal, which you don't really do much on television or film. It's kind of rare. But when I first got there, he said to me, first of all, any questions, anything you need to ask me, if I'm not here, I'm in my trailer, come and see me. He made me feel very comfortable. And then he said, treat the actors as the character on and off camera, which made things actually really a lot easier because I didn't have to relate to them as my hero actors who now I'm nervous, am I going to do a good job?
I
did was I asked the prop master if I could set and reset a poker table with props, so with drinks and bring them drinks. So when the actors first came to the set, like when De Niro first got to the set for our rehearsal, he sat in the chair and I walked up to him and I said, what do you want to drink, Jimmy? And he kind of looked up at me because he was sitting and I was standing and kind of looked up, looked down. He was kind of sus out. And then he said, a shot of Cutty Sark and a glass of water. So then I went and brought him that, even though it was fake. I mean, and we weren't even rehearsing at that point, but...
You weren't even rehearsing. You were just sort of getting... Wow, interesting. Yeah.
But we were on the set. We were getting ready to rehearse.
Yeah.
And there's something sacred about that because everybody's quiet, kind of crew goes away, and it was just an actor's rehearsal with Marty. And I think it seemed like De Niro appreciated that because we didn't have to make small talk of this up and cut, you know, neophyte act movie actor talking to one of the screen legends, you know, it just became about me doing my job. That made it a lot easier.
Yeah. So is that sort of like what you hear when, you know, actors are sort of, they ask to be talked to the entire time by the crew and whatever as that character and behave as that character? I mean, you've heard Daniel Day-Lewis do that apparently. Or is it some hybrid of that is what you were doing?
It wasn't as intense as I hear that is. It was much looser than that because it wasn't like Joe Pesci was cursing at me all day and humiliating me. That didn't happen. It happened during the takes, but not off screen. Actually, they were very kind. They would joke about stuff. It wasn't all they were in character. It's looser. It's a lot looser. I mean, if you see outtakes of Raging Bull, you'll see Robert De Niro cracking up when he's yelling out the window because there's a, you know, a grip, you know, who was there by mistake, and De Niro's laughing at him. He's not Jake LaMotta all the time.
Yeah. But that's fascinating.
But what there was a conservation of energy, right? So De Niro's on the set. When he's not needed on the set, he leaves the set because being on the set can suck your energy out because the lights are there and there's a lot of tension there. People are doing a lot of stuff there.
Yeah.
So I think that's why he didn't want to start making small talk and talking shop and all that. It kind of sucks a little bit of the energy out. So just keep it light, keep it loose, but respect it.
Yeah.
And I think that's what it seemed like to me.
Yeah. I know what you mean. I just shot a part in, The Bleeder with Liev Schreiber, the Chuck Webner story that he's doing. Yeah, it was really cool. It's set in the '70s and we had, one of our scenes at it was pretty involved. It was at a disco. They found a location in Brooklyn and set in the '70s and all that. And, you know, there's like 20 extras. It's dance floor. The scene has to be done while we're dancing. And, you know, we had to block it several times. And my character in that particular scene had to be there a lot because I was in a couple of different moments and making a connection. And it does suck your energy when you're standing around and you're trying to, you know, block, you know, a bunch of people dancing and extras and all of that. And then Liev, and I noticed Liev would go off and, you know, kind of be in his head, just in a corner somewhere. You know, you could just see that he was trying to kind of stay in the moment while we were getting through all of this. You know, it was definitely like...
Yeah. Yeah, and save your energy.
Yeah.
Because, you know, days are long on a set.
Yeah.
And if it, you know, if you get exhausted, you know, it's,
yeah,
you know, it's yeah, not the best situation. Yeah.
Are you, you know, you're into something that I've actually, people have been telling me I should do, and I'm meditation. And I guess, do you still meditate regularly? And is that still a big part of your life?
Yeah. I practiced Tibetan Buddhism. I became a Buddhist about 8 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And meditation obviously is a big part of Buddhist practice. So that is a big part of my life. I just went on a retreat a couple of weeks ago, Buddhist retreat. And I find that it's actually a very, very important part of my life.
What was it, sort of just the business that in the sort of the ups and downs of this? I find that there are times when I need to quiet my mind, and I've like started to explore meditating, you know, because several people have said to me, even if you do it for 5 or 10 minutes in the morning, it kind of centers you and it starts off the day the right way. So for you,
yeah,
like what was it that's, I know that you, I think you have an interest in Allen Ginsberg and the Beat Poets, right? And sort of, like,
yes, very much so.
What was it? How did you get drawn to that world? And was it as a result, which I find sometimes is, you know, there's something not right in one's life, so one goes seek something to make things go a little smoother. Was what started all of this for you?
Well, what happened was, I mean, I started looking into Buddhism when I was really young after reading Jack Kerouac in particular. But when I picked it up, I really didn't understand it. But I liked the idea of it.
Yeah.
But then at some point in my 30s, during The Sopranos, I kind of felt, as part of it was having a big success in life, you know, and making some money and having some fame and realizing that, you know, that those things, those exterior things, don't necessarily make you happy.
Yeah.
And
were you going? Were you going down a rabbit hole a little bit with, like, you know, you got some money, success, and fame, and you're young, and you're single, and you're a good-looking guy, and you're partying?
I wasn't young and single when I was famous and had money. I was already married.
Oh.
So I didn't really worry about that.
Yeah.
I was more like, no, there was more kind of a, you know, you feel like you get on this treadmill where you feel like you have to, you know, the success is an end to the means, or that it's somehow a justification or a validation, or money is, and you realize that it's not.
But it can define you, right? Like, I find sometimes, like, I am in a better mood when I had a good day at work, right? Like, if people said I liked your show or you'd had a great day, I wish I weren't like that. I wish it were pure, and it's like I got a wife and a kid and everything's great, and, you know, but I do
need. But then the converse is true. When you have a bad day and people say you did shit, you have to believe that too. So then you're just at the whims of people's opinions, and you're at the whims of, you know, whether you're doing good work. I felt that those exterior things are just very, you know, it happened after 9/11. After 9/11 happened, I said to myself, because I lived very close, I had to evacuate. I lived right near there.
Mm.
And I was writing an episode of The Sopranos at the time, and I couldn't get myself to sit down and write because I felt like, you know, I was helping out the first few days down there, and I see all these courageous people and firemen and policemen and all medical people and all who are helping. I'm like, you know, when the shit hits the fan, nobody needs a fucking act. I'm sorry. When the shit hits the fan, nobody needs an actor.
You can say fuck.
No.
Yeah, you can
the last thing they need is an actor.
Yeah.
The last thing they need is a TV show. These are the people that
yeah.
And I felt kind of a profound, like, quandary, you know, and
yeah.
emptiness. And a frustration in a way, and it was a combination of that. And then I just felt I started exploring different avenues of spirituality because I felt something was missing, you know. And I had a family and a wife and kids, which made me happy and I love. But I still felt that there's a bigger picture. There's a bigger picture of being a human being on planet Earth and in my relationship to myself, but more from my relationship to everybody else in the world.
It's very hard it's very hard not to be narcissist as a performer, right? Like, just because it's you're putting you out there, right? It's not like I make eyeglass cases, and if you don't like the eyeglass case, it hurts me, but
yeah.
It's the case you don't like, not me. And so, I mean, I'm just speaking for myself. Like, there is that sense of, like, I wish I were better at separating my own sense of self-worth from other people's opinions of me, right? And
well, no, the narcissistic aspect started to really nauseate me about myself and about people I saw being that way. And I found it and find it to be not gratifying and very shallow.
Yeah.
And I much prefer being in the company of people who are not. especially working with people who are not, people who are much more, you know, who are kind and generous and compassionate and altruistic and all those spiritual qualities that everybody admires, you know. And I went through a lot of different spiritual books and different approaches and mysticism and all kinds of things. And
you were given a book by the Amirti, right? Like, were you, you've read Dalai Lama, you saw the Dalai Lama, like you've really like immersed yourself in this, right?
Well, not at first Buddhism, Krishnamurti. I started reading a lot of his stuff, but then I started reading the Dalai Lama, and then I started going to a Buddhist center here in New York, a Tibetan Lama by the name of Gelug Rinpoche. Actually, was Ginsberg, Allen Ginsberg was a student of his, and started, you know, going to Buddhist teachings, and then and that made all the difference to me in my life, and because Buddhism is about working on yourself. Buddhism is not a theistic religion, but doesn't believe in God. Buddha was not a god. Buddha was a man who developed his mind to a point where he kind of realized the full potentiality of being human. And so Buddhism is about dealing with one's own mind and kind of eliminating the negative aspects of it and trying to uncover Buddhism. And Buddhism, they believe that every sentient being has Buddha nature, is already enlightened, has enlightenment within. It's about clearing away all the negative obstacles that get in the way of that. And the path to that, you know, meditation is one of the main avenues to that.
And once you start
to look at yourself and see what you do and see how you're operating and get a sense of it so you can act with more consciousness and awareness and mindfulness.
And at, when you say act, you mean act in life. You're not just talking about acting as an actor, right? You're just talking about how you behave and live your life.
Oh, not, I don't mean acting in for a movie. I mean acting in the world.
In your life,
actions.
How you behave,
keep in mind, even thoughts, you know, because we act through our body, speech, and mind. Our thoughts have a movement to them as well and create an energy as well. When you see someone who's really negative or really dark or really positive and really lovely, you can feel that, those vibrations, or that mood or that feeling, you know, it's palpable.
Yeah. I know we have to wrap, but there's this philosopher, Neville, that believes in manifestation. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but I've sort of been playing with that a bit, and the idea that sort of visualize.
What's his name?
Neville, French philosopher, Neville, and he has tapes. I could even send you a couple where he's a big believer in sort of you need to put yourself in the place where you want to be and not just want to be there. In other words, like you have to believe it at your core. And it doesn't, we're not just talking about career advancement, right? Like whatever it might be, it's the idea, the broader idea of you have control over you more than anything else.
Right.
And you have more power than you know.
But that could be done, you know, you could take that, you know, into a very self-involved, narcissistic way. I mean, I think the thing that Buddhism does is that, especially Tibetan Buddhism, is that the ultimate goal is to help all beings toward enlightenment. So the ultimate goal is to become much more altruistic and kind to other people. It's not so much about yourself so you can, you know, you can be, do more things or you know, it's more about you becoming a better person so you could be better to others.
Right.
You know, without that, then it becomes about me again and me being better, self-help. It's the Buddhism is not self-help.
Yeah.
It's kind of getting yourself to a position where you could be of help to others.
Yeah.
That's the, I think, at least my, what I believe it is.
No, it's a great thing to practice and aspire to, that's for sure. Any other projects coming up? You got the Wannabe?
I have a series coming up in January with Amazon called Mad Dogs.
Okay. And that will kick in right after the first of the year?
I think mid-January goes on.
Okay. And The Wannabes is in theater now, and you can get it on demand. It's in select theaters. It's really been great to talk to you, man. I could talk to you forever.
Same here.
And thank you for doing the show. All right, that was Michael Imperioli. How great is he? A Buddhist. Who knew? Christopher. All that anger. But then underneath it is a very calm man who could kill you with two fingers. Hey, this weekend I'm in New York City performing. Check out my website for appearances there. March 23rd to the 26th, I'm in Edmonton, Canada at the Comic Strip Comedy Club. March 30th to April 1st, I'm at the San Francisco Punchline. I love that club. It's a great, great club. I hope all my fans come out. Again, thanks to everybody who came out to see me at Levity Live this weekend. And please review the podcast. Tell your friends about it. We want to keep building. The numbers are great and getting bigger. Thanks to you. And we'll see you next week.
A Westwood One podcast production.